This is For Your Reference, a sports reference podcast.
Welcome to For Your Reference, a brand new sports reference podcast. Sports Reference brings information to millions of users with the websites you know and love, including Baseball Reference, Basketball Reference, Hockey Reference, FB Ref, Pro Football Reference, College Football Reference, College Basketball Reference, and our powerful search tools under StatHead. You've likely visited one or many of those sites to check out stats on the players, teams, games, and leagues that we cover. And whether you're a casual fan or a dedicated sports historian, we just want to say thanks for being here. My name is Charlotte. I'm one of the data developers at Sports Reference. As you can imagine, I'm very familiar with the data sets our sites are built on and the many rabbit holes they contain. Accidentally falling into a sinkhole of 19th century newspaper clippings or the depths of a player's Instagram account is kind of an occupational hazard. For over 20 years, Sports Reference has stuck to providing the numbers, but today we introduce our brand new podcast that's meant to share the stories behind the numbers. For Your Reference will be an opportunity for you to listen to the Sports Reference team discuss unique sports stories and themes that we've come across while researching, building the sites, and diving into the data ourselves. So thank you again for being here, and let's dive into our very first topic. Today, we're going to talk about the 25th Infantry Wreckers, a segregated Army baseball team that dominated the 19-teens. And we've brought on Adam Dorowski, product director at Sports Reference and head of swag. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you so much for having me, Charlotte.
So when we were brainstorming stories that we would want to tell on this podcast, one of our coworkers actually came to me right away and said, "You've got to get Adam talking about Army baseball teams." And I was like, "Great, this sounds like a perfect first topic." And so my first question is kind of, how did you find yourself in this rabbit hole? How did you end up here?
Oh, goodness. What a great question. In this case, it seems like the rabbit holes have their own rabbit holes, and I've just fallen way too deep. So from the very beginning, in May of 2021, I believe it was, it feels like a million years ago, we updated our site to include the Negro League stats and listed them alongside the American and National League as major leagues. And that was just a huge turning point in my own research. I was always interested in the stats, and I'll admit I had not looked as closely into Negro League players as I should have because of that. We didn't have the stats as readily available, but now, you know, they were listed right alongside every other player that I'd been researching. So I had no excuse not to learn more about these players. And the more I learned about players like Heavy Johnson or Dobie Moore, who I'm sure we're going to be talking about, the more I learned about the fact that we don't have all of their career stats on our sites. And that led me to the rabbit hole of, well, where were these players before 1920 when the Negro National League was founded? And that's when I found out that many of these players that went to the Kansas City Monarchs, for example, were all on the same Army team dominating the Hawaiian baseball scene. And that just led to me figuring out, like, whoa, what was this? Like, what was the whole scene like? What were the players like? How did they develop there? And it's led to me doing Heavy Johnson's Saber bio. I just submitted that one. I'm working on Dobie Moore's now. So as I started working on the bios, I started digging more into the newspaper archives and figuring out what exactly they did with this Army team.
So I definitely want to hear a little bit more about, when we say dominating, like how is that happening and who are these players? But my first question was just, how are they playing baseball, but also in the Army? How do we have time to do both of those things? I had definitely heard of Army baseball teams a little bit before, but I jumped on the Center for Negro League Baseball Research's website, and they said that every base, post, fort, and military installation had a baseball team. And I was like, wow, that is a scale I had not imagined. So I don't know if you can talk a little bit about how much of their duties were being on a baseball team versus being in the Army, and how they had room for both of those.
Yeah, in many cases, for the 25th Infantry Wreckers anyway, their Army duties essentially were playing on the baseball team. A lot of their other duties were overlooked because they provided a service and entertainment to the other soldiers. So they basically played on weekends. Sometimes there were weekday games. But for the most part, they were recruited to play on the baseball team. They were paid as soldiers to essentially play on the baseball team. It's kind of similar, I guess, to some other pre-Negro League teams that were like hotel teams in Florida, like resort teams would hire famous players to essentially be like a waiter or something so that they could, you know, wait on tables a little bit by day and then just dominate the baseball field in the afternoon, that type of thing. Like that, their priority was winning baseball games.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I looked into a little bit of the history of baseball in the Army, and I did see that there were teams as far back as like the Civil War. And at that time, baseball was more prominent just in the East Coast, and Northern prisoners of war were teaching Southerners how to play baseball at their like prisoner of war camps. Mm-hmm. And then we got to like World War One, and there was 101 teams competing, like baseball teams. The Canadian and American soldiers were teaching like French and British soldiers. And we get to like shortly before the armistice, the French soldiers were actually under orders, like official orders, to learn baseball. And I thought that was all pretty interesting. And then you especially get to the history around World War II, and we see these segregated baseball teams. And it's actually kind of an opportunity that these players maybe wouldn't have had outside of the Army. I was reading up a little bit on the Service World Series played between the Army and Navy in 1944. And they had a pitcher, Hal Hairston, and he was a Black pitcher in the Service World Series a year before Jackie Robinson was able to break the color line in Major League Baseball. And so I just thought that was so interesting that this was kind of opportunities that didn't exist elsewhere.
Right. Yeah. And like I said, the Wreckers were playing before the Negro National League had been founded. So Black baseball at that point was not nearly as organized as it would later become in the 1920s. And this was one of the steadiest paychecks that you could get as a Black ball player, was playing for, you know, Uncle Sam. It's nice and steady. You're not playing against the top competition all the time, but this team was so good that like a lot of Pacific Coast League teams and all-star teams of major leagues and minor league players would come and play them in Hawaii.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about the type of competition that they were able to play?
Yeah, they were in some organized leagues in Hawaii when they were there. They were on Oahu, and there was like there were typically two separate leagues they played in. One was they played against other Army units, and one was they played against civilian teams. And those civilian teams were really interesting as well. They were split up typically by, you know, they had an all Chinese team, they had an all Portuguese team, they had an all Native Hawaiian team. So it was all ethnically segregated as well, and the teams all played each other. So this all Chinese team is another thing that I'm kind of falling into a rabbit hole on, because there were some players on those teams that ended up getting some minor league contracts. Buck Lai is a relatively well-known semi-pro player in the States for a long time, and he had some major league contracts that he never played in the AL or NL, but he's a relatively well-known semi-pro star. And there are some others on that team as well. So they would play traveling universities that would come over to Hawaii, traveling Pacific Coast League teams would come over in the winter as part of their training camps. And then eventually the Portland Beavers, yeah, were a big one that came over a few times. But eventually they were transferred from Hawaii to Arizona. And in 1919, Casey Stengel set up an all-star team that came through and played against them. And it was supposed to be a three-game series. The Wreckers won 2 out of 3. Then they added on 2 more games, I presume because they were pretty successful and got a lot of gate money. And the team split those other 2 games as well. So it was very good competition, even though the Wreckers were missing a lot of their best players for that series. But that was the the series where Stengel supposedly told J.L. Wilkinson, who owned the Monarchs, about some of the players that he had just played against and said, you got to get yourself some of these guys. These are amazing ball players.
Yeah. Do we have any idea, since there wasn't Baseball Reference, you know, at that time, who was keeping track of all the games that they were playing? Like, obviously, you know, going there in person is one way to scout them, but how else would we have known the record of this team and how well they were playing?
One thing that made me dive down the rabbit hole was reading enough times in books that there aren't any statistics for that era of the team. So I ended up firing up newspapers.com and found out that the Hawaiian papers, in fact, are all on there now. So I started tabulating all the stats from box score, literally just reading sports sections of every week, finding box scores. I probably have like 150 box scores now, which, you know, over a few seasons, that's pretty good when they're playing weekly. And, you know, started to put together a statistical record of these teams. Now, the coverage that they received, you know, it spanned as far as, you know, the Chicago Defender was covering this team. The Spalding Company wanted to get the team to come to the West Coast to do a tour, but they couldn't because they had their army duties. So they were well known in the Black community as one of the best teams out there. But, you know, they also had their army duties that they had to contend with.
Yeah, the talent on the team is pretty incredible. I kept wondering just like, how did they all end up on that same one team? I guess, you know, there were such limited opportunities. So in that sense, you can kind of understand. But we really had such a concentration of talent. You were saying it was Casey Stengel who sort of was the connector, came and saw them in person. And then I guess what I learned about him was he was a Kansas City native. And so I guess he just went back home and he talked to Wilkinson, who was starting up the Monarchs, the Kansas City Monarchs, and was like, hey, check out these guys. Some sort of something went on where they made that connection. And the Kansas City Monarchs ended up getting, I don't know if you can confirm, but I think I counted 9 different guys on Baseball Reference who we had listed as infantry wreckers and appeared for the Monarchs.
Yeah, the list keeps growing as I discover more. I've got it up to 13 now. There are a few more that I discovered since then. Some of them were very prominent players for the Monarchs. I mentioned Heavy Johnson, Dobie Moore. Bullet Rogan is the one Hall of Famer from the group. Hurley McNair was another great Monarchs player who didn't play with them in Hawaii, so I don't have any box scores for him, but he did play with them in Arizona. And then there's, you know, just a few others that played, you know, a year or two in the Negro Leagues as well. Now, in terms of how, like the connection between J.L. Wilkinson, it's a little bit fuzzy. He did know Bullet Rogan from Rogan being a Kansas City, Kansas native. And Rogan actually did play for the All Nations team, which was also a team that was operated by J.L. Wilkinson before this 1919 series. He played with that team when he was on furlough earlier. So some people say that Casey Stengel discovered all of them. He didn't discover Rogan, but there is some pretty good evidence that he told J.L. Wilkinson that, you know, there's more there than just Rogan. So keep an eye out.
Yeah, it seemed like the first Kansas City Monarchs team was almost a like smashing together of Wreckers and All Nations to form one team. And that was fascinating to me too, because the All Nations team was actually mixed and included Black, white, Native, Hawaiian players. That was kind of the point of the All Nations team. Mm-hmm. But of course, once they became a Negro Leagues team, I'm assuming they changed that formation. Yeah.
Yeah, although one of the, you know, they had Black players like John Donaldson that came over. They had Cuban players like Jose Mendez that joined the Monarchs. So Black and Afro-Latino players on the All Nations did join the Monarchs.
Sure. And I guess I am aware, because both of us as part of Sports Reference have visited Kansas City and the Negro League Baseball Museum. And so I'm very familiar with the Monarchs' sort of early dynasty. When the Negro Leagues were getting started in the 19, 20s, or at least the Negro National League, they were the number one team in the league in 22, 23, 24, 25, 26. They won the first Negro League World Series, like just absolutely dominated. And a lot of that was due to these players that all kind of came over clustered from the infantry wreckers. So yeah, I guess maybe we could talk a little bit more about some of these particular players.
Right. Like the one that I started writing the Saber bio for, Heavy Johnson. My rabbit hole for him started on Baseball Reference because he came over from this Army team and he hit 406 in his first year. And then he followed that up by hitting 406 again and winning the Triple Crown. And this is in a league that had so many offensive stars. So it's not like a depleted league that he's dominating here. This is like the best of the best in Black baseball. And that made me think this Army team had to be pretty good if like all these guys came over and like you said, half the team was pretty much from the wreckers and they dominated the league. Dobie Moore could have been the best Black shortstop in Negro Leagues history had he not been shot and shattered his leg in six places in 1926, which coincidentally, that's when their reign of penance ended. And Bullet Rogan, of course, I mean, for my money, you know, he might be the best Negro Leagues player, period. He's Shohei Ohtani, you know, 100 years ago. He was the dominant pitcher in the league, and he was also their cleanup hitter and later manager. Just an incredible figure in baseball history. And to learn about how he got started with the 25th Infantry, and then actually before that with the 24th Infantry in the Philippines, that's a whole other rabbit hole in itself.
Yeah, that's crazy. I was definitely amazed by Bullet Rogan stats when I was clicking through these players preparing for the podcast. We have a season for him at age 44. I was like, that's crazy. Like, that's a Tom Brady level.
Well, now because I went through those box scores, we have stats for him in Hawaii for the first time ever. And in 44 games pitched, I have him 32-3. With I don't have earned runs, but his runs allowed per nine innings was 1.06. So his earned run average is probably like two-thirds of that, like 0.67 or something. And then he also hit 337 and slugged 637. Just an unbelievable player.
I'm almost not sure I want to make a comparison, but when you talk about, you know, Bullet Rogan's pitching record or Heavy Johnson hitting like 406, how many players were hitting over 400 in the MLB at that time? Like, I know it's just, it's always like we want to put them on that same level, but it's so hard to compare because they face so many different challenges and different disadvantages.
Right. It was more common back then. That's when Rogers Hornsby and Ty Cobb would frequently hit 400. So it was done quite a bit more often. I think people who try to downplay the Negro League statistics because they weren't playing against white competition also have to remember that, you know, Ty Cobb and Rogers Hornsby did not have to face Jose Mendez, did not have to face John Donaldson, Bullet Rogan, and all of the top Black pitchers. So I think that we see some of these eye-popping stats on both the Black side and the white side because the league has not been the leagues had not come together and created this ultra high talent level that you would see in like the late 40s, early 50s. Like that was probably when the Major League Baseball was at the highest level in terms of talent because the Negro Leagues had merged in with the AL and NL and expansion hadn't kept up. So they were just dominant players at every position, it seemed like.
Sure. And it's so hard to compare the stats in general because the leagues operated so differently. Some of the things that I learned about the Negro League teams not being able to like secure a stadium for a full season or just so many reasons that they weren't able to kind of accumulate the same stats, or even if they were accumulating stats, they weren't being recorded in the same ways.
Right. Yeah. One thing to remember too is like, we have Heavy Johnson hitting 406 in 68 games in 1922. So that sounds like it's not a full season, but that's because in between those 68 games, the Monarchs were playing a whole bunch of barnstorming games so they could make enough money to make it to the next city to keep playing those games. I mean, they weren't as cash strapped as some of the other Negro League teams were, but you get the idea that they needed these additional games. This was against, you know, town teams and other teams that never appear in this record, but it was very much a part of the schedule that they played.
What are the areas that you're still hoping to discover? What are kind of the hidden treasure box scores that you haven't found that you think might be out there?
I have nothing in Arizona. Like, the coverage was so amazing in Hawaii, but then as soon as they went to Arizona, you would get like a paragraph here or a paragraph there and an occasional score. In fact, the only Wreckers box score I have from their time in the continental United States was when they faced the St. Louis Giants, who were a Negro League team. They faced them in St. Louis. And that was essentially the week where the Wreckers and many other Army teams were in town for the Olympic trials. And that's when a lot of the players were bought out of their Army obligations. And several of them joined the Monarchs. A pair joined the Giants. Some others joined other teams as well. That was kind of when the Wreckers started falling apart a little bit. Heavy Johnson, though, had to stick around for a couple more years, presumably because he was not the best soldier, and they made him stay as long as they could possibly keep him.
Yeah, perhaps the end of the podcast isn't the time to clarify timeline, but I think what I have in my notes is 1913 was when the Wreckers were first in Hawaii, and then I don't know if you have the time that they ended up in Arizona.
Yeah, 1913 is when they arrived in Hawaii. 1914 is when we start seeing Heavy Johnson. 1915, we see Rogan. 1916 is when Moore arrives. Late 1918 is when they moved to Arizona. And then by 1920, the team players had started leaving the team to join the Negro Leagues.
And of course, by 1922, they're all contributing to the number one Negro League national team.
So. Oh, yes.
Well, this has been totally fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing this fun story with us about this crazy team that absolutely dominated. And thank you all for joining us and listening. If you have any rabbit holes that you've been down, any questions or ideas for us, please do reach out at podcast@sportsreference.com. Send us an email. Talk to you all later.